Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
Hey, everyone. Tom Salemi here. Welcome back. This is the OIS Podcast. Thanks for joining us. We've been hearing a great deal about the impact of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. This is a tax cut that pharma companies and life sciences companies and companies in tech and from other industries have been anticipating a long time, hoping that it would come for a long time. And now we're hearing about the potential impact with Apple announcing it would be paying $38 billion in taxes and bringing over $200 billion more and investing much of that in R&D. Leads us to wonder what impact these dollars will have on M&A and R&D expenditures in pharma, in medtech, and ophthalmology. So I thought the best way to get some insights on that, if there are any to be had, would be to call the analysts that are covering a lot of the companies we follow. So I did that, and we'll have this week's episode called The Analyst Call. Will be based upon my interviews with three good friends to the podcast, David Nierengarten of Wedbush Securities, Liev Abraham of Citigroup, and Mike Mattson of Needham & Company, who actually Mike and I have talked for years, but this is the first time we'll have them on a podcast. And we'll take the calls one by one as I interviewed them all individually. And we'll start off with Dave Nierengarten. Dave and I talked a bit about the impact of the tax bill overall or the tax reform overall and what the billions mean for pharma. And then we'll talk a bit about some specific companies that could be potential acquisition targets. We're seeing a lot of movement in the biopharma industry. The acquisition this week announced of Juno, which was enormous, $9 billion. So there is a lot going on. It hasn't quite touched ophthalmology yet, but let's talk to Dave Nierengarten of Wedbush Securities to see if it will. But before I get into my conversation with Dave Nierengarten, I would like to remind you that OIS at ASCRS is happening on April 12th. If you know you're going to be there in Washington, D.C., you should sign up before February 1st. You'll only pay $895, which is a $200 savings off the full price. So again, if you know you're going to be joining us on April 12th at OIS at ASCRS, please register before February 1st. Now we'll get into this conversation with Dave Nierengarten of Wedbush, and we'll get right into Dave's answer to my question about what will the impact or the inflow of these tax dollars mean to pharma. And in this conversation, Dave and I talk about a couple of ophthalmology companies that could be impacted. Well, Dave Nierengarten, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Just trying to get my head around what all this influx of capital coming from outside the U.S. into the U.S. through the pharma companies means for the M&A market. What has the impact been so far since the beginning of the year? We've obviously seen some huge deals.
Yeah, we've seen some large deals, of course, this morning with Bioverativ and confirming the rumors about Juno and Celgene acquiring Juno Therapeutics. And, of course, last year we did see Gilead buying Kite, but more to the point, this year what's changed is, you know, the new corporate tax rate and ability of companies to repatriate cash at a relatively low rate, you know, gives them a lot of dry powder to play with. And I think the calculation has changed for companies that are either commercial stage or near commercial stage, that their valuations are now more attractive relative to where they were, you know, last year, the last couple of years, given the new corporate tax rate and such. So I think the pharma companies are willing to bid a bit higher than they were in order to buy these companies. And that's what you're seeing in the first few weeks of the year.
I'm sure the pharma companies have had their shopping lists and always have a shopping list. What are some of the qualities that put a company up at the top of the list?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the qualities, the generally common qualities that I've seen besides being late stage or already commercial is, you know, either, you know, one, complementing a current platform or current effort. So, you know, Celgene has, you know, in their offer to Juno, of course, they have synergies or at least overlap in efforts in hematological malignancies, particularly multiple myeloma, along with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then the other thing that you see or saw last year with Gilead and Kite is, you know, potentially going in a new or additional direction for the company with a broad push into a new therapeutic area or something that's maybe a little bit less, you know, directly related to what the company is already doing. But I think that the primary focus for a lot of these companies initially, a lot of pharma companies, will be to buy complementary things. You know, I think we're going to see that ticked off their shopping list first, like Sanofi Genzyme buying Bioverativ. That was a fairly, you know, obvious fit for them. And so, you know, I think you'll see, you know, those companies getting gobbled up first, followed by, you know, a bit more speculative things or a few, you know, what I would call platform enhancers, you know, that provide technological capabilities that the acquirer otherwise, you know, wouldn't have or doesn't want to spend the time to replicate on their own.
Is this likely to drive OUS buyers as well, because now their competitors have the funds to make deals that perhaps they were not ready to make before, but they are ready to make now because there is another potential bidder at the table?
Yeah, I think that does enhance the valuations of all the companies, you know, by bringing in additional bidders. I think some of the ex-U.S. companies like Sanofi, again, for example, have traditionally been less successful acquiring companies and been outbid. Now I think, you know, the full realization of, you know, the ability of U.S. pharma companies to make bids and make higher bids is going to, you know, just add to that, add to the valuations that, you know, pop up here, you know, by adding to the bidder pool. You know, I think the, you know, ex-US companies, you know, the European pharmas, they've done their share of acquisitions. It's not totally, totally game changing for them, but, you know, I think they will be forced to spend a little bit more than they're used to and, you know, again, add to the number of bidders at the table for these assets.
So even though Novartis obviously is not impacted by this, now that a U.S. rival has more capital, we might see some European companies step up. You mentioned...
Roche, et cetera,
You mentioned the possibility of, or the likelihood that companies would buy complementary pipelines. So when we look at a Pfizer... or Merck, those companies have, if you look at the list of capital that they're able to now bring into the U.S., it's a lot of money, $86 million for Pfizer, according to the Wall Street Journal, $63 billion for Merck, I should say, $86 billion for Pfizer. I mean, they're ophthalmology pipeline, they don't have an ophthalmology practice, but is there any likelihood that they could use this money to move into new sectors, or again, this doesn't alter their strategy at all. They probably stick to their knitting.
You know, I think it does. It does increase the probability. It doesn't, you know, make it, you know, slam dunk that Pfizer is going to, you know, expand into a new therapeutic area. I think what has happened in the past with spikes in M&A and what's going to happen here is that, you know, again, the companies focus on the nearest to their heart, you know, the nearest to their core competency first. And then they start thinking about, do we need to add, you know, ophthalmology? Do we need to add dermatology? You know, I mean, there's you know, sectors that these pharmas have divested in the past that, you know, you could see come back into the fold, as it were, with the added resources that they have now.
Do you think there are any ophthalmology companies in our OIS universe that are on these lists, be they privately held or publicly traded? And could we see some deals involving ophthalmology companies going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think we could. You know, ophthalmology has always had a benefit of being a relatively focused, relatively focused area. And so it's not, you know, again, certainly not impossible for a company of pharma acquirer to, you know, pretty rapidly build the infrastructure, sales force, and things like that for an ophthalmology company. So, you know, some of the later stage, I don't cover Aerie Pharmaceuticals, but it is later stage, you know, and they do have, you know, they do have efforts there that, you know, have had clinical trial successes. you know, another one that I do cover, although I'm underperform on it, admittedly, is Spark Therapeutics. You know, they do have gene therapy and ophthalmology and gene therapy, you know, and CAR Ts and such have certainly been thrown around as, you know, acquisition targets. You know, AGTC, you know, has a deal with Biogen, you know, around their ophthalmology gene therapy projects there, although admittedly it's not that late stage. You know, and so there's, yeah, there are companies with current deals and independent companies that could be taken out in the near future. But again, I think the first priority is likely to be, you know, the companies that are closest to what the pharma is doing right now, and then they start, you know, expanding the circle over time.
Excellent. Well, thank you for the thoughts. I'm sure you're very busy these days tracking all these deals down, so I appreciate your taking a few minutes.
It's been fun.
I next had the pleasure of speaking with Liev Abraham of Citi. We've had Liev on the podcast a few times, and she's also an OIS regular, so it's great to hear from her again. Again, I opened up the conversation asking about the impact that these new tax dollars could have on ophthalmology and pharma. But then our conversation veered toward Allergan, which is a company that Liev covers. We talk about Allergan extensively in this week's OIS Weekly. If you don't get that, you can sign up for it at OIS.net. You can also see the article there. Allergan, of course, is losing its exclusivity over the Restasis patent and expecting some competition. And that's having an impact on business. Allergan announced some severe job cuts. And I talked a bit about Liev, about what those mean to Allergan and what Allergan's commitment to ophthalmology is. We asked CEO Brent Saunders about that back at OIS at AO, and that was before the job cuts were announced. So it's great to hear from Liev Abraham, an analyst who has been covering the company, about what those impacts mean. So let's hear from Liev Abraham. But before I get into this conversation with Liev Abraham, I did want to tell you about our Triple Play program. Since it's the beginning of the year, you can actually register for all three OISs at the same time using our Triple Play program. You'll save 30% on the registration. So go to OIS.net, register for the Triple Play program before February 1st, and you'll save 30%, which is a whole lot of money. Now let's hear from Liev Abraham of Citi.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of pharma and their the extent of offshore earnings that have been thus far trapped kind of offshore, and companies penalized for bringing those earnings into the U.S. That is no longer the case following the implementation of the tax bill. And so there will be a deemed repatriation of those offshore earnings. And there are many companies, Pfizer and Merck, just two of them, but many others, that have large amounts of offshore earnings trapped offshore that will be coming in to the U.S. With companies able to spend that cash more freely and without penalties. Companies thus far have been somewhat cautious about what they about the uses of that cash, but there's certainly it certainly opens up the possibility for more M&A and more large scale M&A across the sector. No company has yet come out and made a definitive statement as to what they'll do. This will necessarily increase M&A or R&D across the business in a big way, but it certainly increases the optionality for that, and the, you know, also expectations increase alongside that as well.
Is there a preference stated by Wall Street or shareholders as to how that capital is used? Are there pressures for buybacks, for paying it back to investors, or anything not involving M&A, or is there an appetite for investing in innovation and building out pipelines?
I think there is always an appetite for investing in pipelines across the sector, and historically speaking, companies that invest in pipelines that have played out and yielded returns have been rewarded for that. As with all as with all things, it's all about investing in the right type of R&D, and if you're investing in M&A, in the right types of in the right types of deals. You know, historically speaking, and this is just industry data, in the last big repatriation or tax holiday, a large majority of the cash that was repatriated was returned to shareholders. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this time around. But there is certainly a need and an appetite, certainly amongst investors, for innovation, for M&A, and for R&D that yields returns always.
And do you have any sense as to how that might play specifically to ophthalmology, since this is an ophthalmology podcast? Are there some of the players in this space? Do you have a stronger feeling about them one way or the other as to how they might use the capital?
Well, a lot of the ophthalmology players in the space are small players, so it'll be interesting to see if some of the small players could potentially be targets for other companies. In terms of the large players, the one that I will speak to is Allergan. Allergan will not be affected, at least as it relates to repatriation of offshore earnings, will not be affected by this tax bill because they are an Irish company, not a U.S. company. So they've never been limited by the domicile of their cash in terms of their M&A and deal making, in terms of their rationale or their thinking or priorities. So don't see this affecting Allergan's decision making process in a big way at all. But for some of the smaller companies, it could, as with the rest of smaller cap biotech, it could well make them more amenable to being targets.
And speaking of Allergan, will they get back to the news that they had announced at the start of the year and had hinted at the end of last year with the expiration of the Restasis patent and the expectation of generics coming in? They've made some cuts to. Cut over 1,000 jobs, which is more than 5% of their workforce, eliminate another 400 currently open positions. This is at least according to reports. You might have better numbers than I do. What are your feelings about the status of Allergan's ophthalmology business? I was listening to their J.P. Morgan presentation, and it's meaningless, of course, but it was the fourth business mentioned when Brent Saunders gave his presentation there. I didn't know if that suggested a slippage of any kind, if that's where it's always been. But how is Allergan's ophthalmology business looking?
So they do have challenges in their current ophthalmology franchise, as you mentioned. Restasis is expected to face generic competition this year, and this is a big product of theirs. It's $1.5 billion in revenue, so not a small product by any means. However, as you did note as well, they have committed to ophthalmology as being a core therapeutic area. I didn't really pay much attention as to where they put it on the pecking order. I think what was more interesting is some of the other therapeutic areas that they have, such as anti-infectives or their cardiovascular franchise, which were not on that list. So I think the important thing is it was on that list. I think the future of that franchise as it relates to growth really depends on the success of their pipeline. They do have some key assets in the pipeline as it relates to ophthalmology. One of them is DARPin or bisoprolol for wet AMD, and that phase 3 trial reads out later this year. And then they also have a program, one asset called bimatoprost sustained release, bimatoprost SR, which is a long acting therapy for glaucoma. So we're waiting for those two readouts to really see what the future of the ophthalmology franchise looks like longer term. And again, as it relates to bolt-on acquisitions, and these are the types of deals that their CEO, Brent Saunders, has talked about, not large-scale M&A, this would be one of the therapeutic areas that they would be targeting, given that it is one of their core therapeutic areas.
And they have, of course, been acquisitive in the past with Equisys and Oculi, which is now TruTier. Any update on either of those programs? Is Elgen still stent? Is that... any idea on its performance or TruTier's performance?
It's very early days. Both of those have only pretty recently been launched, and they're targeting kind of new modalities, one for treating glaucoma and the other for dry eyes. I think it's pretty early days, but it's certainly something that we will be monitoring and following up on. I think we'll have a better sense in 2018 versus 2017, and I guess I would say I would. At the moment, it's probably a very small proportion of sales, but stay tuned.
So looking forward, last question, what kind of year do you anticipate for pharma in 2018 in terms of M&As? Should we expect an uptick? Is it too early to say? What are your feelings?
Well, the early signs are that there already has been a bit of an uptick just with the deals announced this morning. Those are the early signs. I guess we'll have to wait and see if that continues. But certainly the early signs indicate maybe not large-scale M&A, but certainly as it relates to medium-sized bolt-on transactions, just factually speaking, we've already seen, we have already seen some transactions, some announced this morning and a couple a few weeks ago at JP Morgan.
All right. Well, thank you again for the thoughts. It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure to be with you.
So we are clearly seeing an uptake in pharma M&A, but what about medtech? For that take, I talked with Mike Mattson. Mike is a senior analyst at Needham & Company. And we talked broadly about the impact that these tax dollars coming into the U.S. will have on medtech M&A. Let's have a listen. So Mike Mattson, thanks for joining us. We're looking at, by my count, of the dollars that could be brought into the U.S. by medtech companies that have kept those profits offshore, $200 billion. If you take away Medtronic and J&J, it's $100 billion. Either whatever source you use, however you count it up, it's a lot of money coming into medtech. I wonder if there's been any communication from the companies as to how those dollars may be used. No one seems to be pulling an Apple where they're telling you exactly how they're going to be spending, you know, $350 million over the next 5 years.
Yeah, so the companies haven't been very specific, although, you know, a lot of them have said that they plan to use it for either returning cash to shareholders through increasing dividends or buying back stock, as well as M&A. But most of them haven't really been specific about how much they plan to allocate to each of those things. You know, I would note that some companies have had to borrow money in the U.S. against money that was trapped outside the U.S., so there could be some debt repayment as well. But I do think that this will ultimately translate into increased M&A. The big companies all are looking for, you know, new growth drivers. And, you know, one of the best ways to do that is to go out and buy shiny new things that are growing really fast.
We've seen some deals on the biopharma side. Juno, I think, is the most obvious one, but some others as well. I don't know if those deals, I get the sense those deals weren't necessarily in the works for very long, but I also don't think that someone just walked into a boardroom with a suitcase full of cash and made an offer. But do things typically move faster on the biopharma side than on the medtech side? Will it take longer in medtech just because that's the nature of things?
So I'm not sure I can really answer that, you know, not being a banker or not being involved with business development at any of these companies. But, you know, I would guess that it's similar, and it's more really the timing is driven by the size of the deal. I would suspect that the larger the deal, the longer it takes to get done. Just seems to make logical sense. I would suspect that to the degree that the tax reform bill accelerates M&A, we'll probably start to see that more later this year. That's not to say we won't see deals in the early part of this year, but I think that, you know, because these things do take some time to get done, particularly the larger deals, if it really was triggered by the availability of this cash from tax reform, from repatriation, that's going to show up more maybe in the second half of the year. Smaller deals maybe could happen sooner than that. You know, I do expect this to accelerate M&A. M&A, by the way we track it, did slow down a little bit last year relative to the prior year. But, you know, I expect it to be stronger going forward.
And is there any way of knowing whether the acquisitions could be additions to businesses that already exist? Or is this an opportunity for MedTech really to kind of move into a new space that they haven't been before and really kind of change the direction of their company, but add another element to what they do?
Well, I mean, I think that it's more of the former. You know, it doesn't mean that we won't see some of the latter as well in terms of companies moving into new areas. But, you know, based on my experience as an analyst, having covered the sector for 14 years now, you know, what I've seen is that the deals that are the most successful tend to be smaller tuck-in type deals that fall into areas that the companies are already competing in. Those seem to create value. Sometimes the large deals and entering areas that the companies are not competing in right now, taking them too far astray from things that they know and distracting them from their core business, don't tend to work out as well. So So I'd hope for the sake of investors that we don't see as much of that. It's not the size of the deal again. It's just more about whether or not it's kind of a part of the, you know, related to their kind of core business that they're already participating in.
And are there any therapeutic areas that are likely to be the target of acquirers more than the other? Will you see more deals in orthopedics or cardiovascular, maybe deeper moves into digital health by some medtech players?
I think it really could be anywhere and everywhere. I think it really depends more on the particular asset that you're looking at. You know, from my perspective, you know, I think what, you know, there's a few things that make companies attractive to acquirers. You know, the first is revenue growth. So as I mentioned, these larger companies, you know, their growth has slowed now to kind of the mid-single digits typically. And they're all looking for things that will accelerate that growth. So companies that are in areas with, you know, underpenetrated markets, new therapies that have a lot of growth potential, that makes them attractive. The second thing is the gross margins. I think companies with high gross margins are attractive, particularly if they're higher than those at the company that's the buyer, because that can make it pretty accretive. They're less concerned, I think, about the bottom line profitability or the operating margins at the company they're acquiring, because a lot of times when you buy, you know, these small companies tend to be subscale and there's a lot of overhead costs for to pay the CEO and their headquarters and things like that. And when you put this together with a bigger company, you can cut out a lot of those costs. And so if you have a high gross margin, you know, it can become pretty profitable in the hands of a bigger company, even if it wasn't necessarily profitable as an independent entity. So those are kind of the things I would point to. I think there's examples of that really across every area in med tech.
Interesting. And final question, just I'll ask you to name names, and perhaps you can't, but we've seen some interesting deals by Stryker, and they're bringing some money. We haven't seen a lot from Medtronic, and I don't think you cover Medtronic, and they're bringing in over $30 billion. I mean, do you anticipate any specific company being more acquisitive in 2018, whether it's related to this influx of cash or not?
I think it's hard to predict. I mean, I think that they're all out there looking. I mean, Stryker, as you mentioned, you know, has been one of the more active acquirers recently. I think that'll continue to be the case. But you know, some of these companies that haven't been as active could step up and start to do more deals. You know, it's just really hard to predict, you know, and we could, you know, whether they're large deals, small deals, again, it's hard to say, but I think there's going to be more of everything this year and into 2019.
Excellent. Well, it should be an interesting year. Thanks for taking a few minutes to share your thoughts.
No problem.
Well, that is a wrap. Thank you, Dave Nierengarten, Liev Abraham, and Mike Mattson for joining us on the OIS podcast. It's great to have your perspective on this interesting trend, this influx of dollars coming back into U.S. healthcare. Thank you, OIS podcast listeners, for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this analyst call episode. We'll do this from time to time. Please do me a favor, if you would. If you would shoot me an email, let me know what you thought. tom@healthag.com. The word health followed by letters EGY.com. Healthag is the producer of the OIS podcast and the OIS events. You can also reach me at Twitter. I am @MedTechTom. You can also reach OIS at @OISTweets. And of course, you can follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter, and we'll put these podcasts out there. Finally, if you wouldn't mind giving us a ranking on iTunes, that helps other folks find the program. And of course, tell your friends about the podcast as well. That's a wrap, folks. Tune in next week for another Tale of Innovation. And don't forget to register for OIS at ASCRS. It's happening on April 12th. We'd love to see you in Washington, D.C.